Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
45 are killed in a Nigerian militant attack, and Egypt extends the presidential election by one day. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. At least 45 Nigerian security personnel are dead after gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants attacked the town of Bunyadi. Hundreds of gunmen on trucks and motorcycles stormed the town in the northeastern Yobe state late on Monday. A source with Nigeria's Joint Task Force tells VOA's Hausa service that 24 soldiers and 21 police officers were confirmed dead following the attack. The source, who spoke on condition of anonymity, says the gunmen took away an armored tank and many vehicles. Egypt's election commission has extended the presidential poll by one day in an effort to increase voter turnout in an election that is widely expected to bring former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to power. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Women wearing headscarves cheered and ululated as voters lined up outside a women's polling station in the Cairo working class district of Imbaba. Many families took advantage of the official holiday to lounge around local polling stations, snacking on beans and falafel, and listening to music. At a polling station in the district of Manufia, north of Cairo, the local electoral head, Judge Wal Omran, said the vote was going smoothly and he anticipated no problems. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
Nearly 40 people are dead after al-Shabaab militants attacked a village on the border between Ethiopia and Somalia. The governor of Somalia's Bakool region tells VOA that the Islamist militant group raided the village of Ato early today. He says 27 pro-government militiamen and 12 al-Shabaab fighters were killed in the ensuing clash. U.S. President Barack Obama has telephoned Petro Poroshenko to congratulate him on his victory Sunday in Ukraine's long-awaited presidential election. The White House said Mr. Obama offered him the full support of the United States as he seeks to unify and move his country forward. Poroshenko said Monday that peace can be reached through dialogue, but that armed pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine, whom he called terrorists, must be defeated militarily. A spokesman for Thailand's military tells VOA that the influence of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat is a fundamental problem that must be solved before power can be returned to a civilian government. The remark came today as the army continued its crackdown on dissent, arresting the education minister. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports.
Soldiers entered the Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand and seized Chatharan Chaisung, one of the fugitive ministers from the ousted cabinet.
Make way. Give him space. Give him space.
Chatharan had defied the junta's order to surrender under martial law. Speaking to journalists minutes before he was taken away, Chatharan insisted it was legitimate for anyone to peacefully demonstrate or speak out against the coup.
Coup d'etat is not a solution to the problems or conflicts in Thai society, but will make the conflicts even worse.
The military has carried out 19 coups or attempted overthrows of civilian governments since the end of the absolute monarchy in 1932. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Australia has concluded that the Malaysian passenger jet missing since early March likely crashed into the Indian Ocean after running out of fuel. The Australian report today said the conclusion was based on analysis on the final brief data exchange between the jet with 239 people aboard and a satellite monitoring air traffic. White House aides say President Barack Obama is seeking to keep 9,800 American troops in Afghanistan after completing combat operations at the end of 2014 and then withdraw almost all of them by the end of 2016. The aides say Mr. Obama will announce the country's next military steps in his 13-year Afghan war during a speech late today. Pregnant and lactating women need to make sure they're getting enough iodine in their diets. That recommendation comes from the American Academy of Pediatrics. Iodine is essential for proper brain development of growing babies, both before and after birth. But a new study found that about a third of pregnant women in the U.S. are mildly iodine deficient, and only 15% take iodine supplements. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The head of Nigeria's military says the 276 kidnapped girls have been located, but the military will not attempt to rescue them by force. President Goodluck Jonathan has ruled out negotiating with the kidnappers, militant sect Boko Haram.
That's VOA's Ann Look with the latest from Abuja. Details next. Also in the news, nearly 40 people are dead after Al-Shabaab militants attacked a village on the border between Ethiopia and Somalia. And the Egyptian government has proclaimed an official holiday on the second and final day of a two-day presidential election. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Namibia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, at least 45 Nigerian security personnel are dead after gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants attacked the town of Buniyadi. Hundreds of gunmen on trucks and motorcycles stormed the town in northeastern Yobe State late yesterday. A source with Nigeria's Joint Task Force tells VOA that 24 soldiers and 21 police officers were confirmed dead following the attack. The source, who spoke on condition of anonymity, says the gunmen took away an armored tank and many vehicles. There has been no word on civilian casualties. Ibrahim Ahmed, a reporter for VOA's Hausa service, is in northeastern Nigeria. He reports that militants are also attacking motorists on highways leading in and out of Maiduguri, a city in Borno State. Drivers say snipers wait in trees to fire at passing cars, which are then attacked by gunmen hiding in bushes by the side of the road. Despite promises of action from President Goodluck Jonathan, Nigerian security forces have not been able to stop the increasingly frequent attacks, either claimed or blamed on Boko Haram. The head of Nigeria's military says the 276 kidnapped schoolgirls have been located, but the military will not attempt to rescue them by force. President Goodluck Jonathan has ruled out negotiating with the kidnappers' militant sect, Boko Haram. VOA's Ann Look has the latest from Abuja.
Nigeria's defense chief, Marshal Alex Bade, says he knows where the girls are, 6 weeks after their kidnapping in northeastern Nigeria. Speaking in Abuja, Bade would give no details about the location. He said a forceful rescue operation would be too dangerous and could kill the girls. But he said military officials are working on it and, quote, know what they are doing, despite accusations to the contrary. President Goodluck Jonathan has ruled out negotiations, including the militants' demand for a prisoner swap. He said Sunday the girls must be released unconditionally. It's unclear what options remain or what role these public statements could be having in any back-channel talks. Presidential Senior Special Advisor on Public Affairs, Doyin Okupe.
But I'm sure government has a program, you know, and even if I know, I cannot say it on air. You know, but there is definitely, because, you know, there is an overwhelming commitment by government, especially the president, that these girls, within the shortest period of time, you know, must be found and must be released. So, I'm sure they have something up their sleeves.
VOA spoke by phone with family members of the missing girls about what the military chief called the, quote, good news that the girls had been located. Those relatives said their hopes have been raised before. They say they'll believe it when they see the girls home safe. Attacks either claimed by or blamed on Boko Haram continue to occur in northern Nigeria, leaving hundreds dead this month. Analysts warn that militants could grab more students or civilians, even if the Chibok schoolgirls are freed. Nigeria accepted assistance from the United States and other countries to help find the girls, but Nigeria has ruled out a foreign troop deployment. Ann Look, VOA News, Abuja.
Nearly 40 people are dead after Al-Shabaab militants attacked a village on the border between Ethiopia and Somalia. The governor of Somalia's Bakool region, Mohamed Abdi Tall, tells VOA that the Islamist militant group raided the village of Ato early today. He says 27 pro-government militiamen and 12 Al-Shabaab fighters were killed in the ensuing clash. Afterwards, the town remained in control of the militias, who had been working with governments on both sides of the border. Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab has lost most of the territory it once controlled in Somalia, but remains a threat to the country's African Union-backed government. On Saturday, Al-Shabaab fighters stormed Somalia's parliament building in Mogadishu, killing 10 security personnel and wounding 4 lawmakers. 8 militants were also killed. In February, Al-Shabaab attacked the presidential palace. The president was not harmed, but at least 17 other people were killed. The United Nations Refugee Agency says tens of thousands of South Sudanese have fled their home since the government and rebel forces signed a truce agreement almost 3 weeks ago. The UNHCR says people are fleeing continued fighting and the fear of not having enough food. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
This is the second truce signed by the warring factions since fighting in South Sudan broke out in mid-December. Like the first, it is proving to have a very short life. The UN Refugee Agency reports that in barely 3 weeks, escalating fighting between the government and rebels has caused 46,000 more people to flee, bringing South Sudan's internally displaced to more than 1 million. More than 20,000 people also fled to neighboring Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda, swelling the refugee numbers to 370,000. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says Ethiopia is hosting more than 131,000. Most are women and children.
Recent arrivals say they fled fighting in neighboring Jonglei and Upper Nile states, the areas around Matiang in Longchuk County in Upper Nile state. Those from other areas said they feared imminent attack or food insecurity.
Edward says Ethiopia cannot keep up with the swarm of people arriving. He says an average of 1,000 South Sudanese arrive each day, and 3 refugee camps that opened this year are overflowing. He says the UNHCR and Ethiopian authorities are looking for land to erect a 4th camp. The UNHCR also cares for some 320,000 refugees from Sudan who are sheltering in the Maban area of Upper Nile in South Sudan. It estimates some 4 million people face severe food shortages in the country. Because of the fighting, Edwards says many people are unable to farm, depriving them of normal food sources.
We are worried about the food situation and the impact that might have on further displacement, but clearly, at the moment, the fundamental cause, insecurity, I think, is probably the most immediate of the worries. That's not to downplay the food insecurity risk at all, but it's just to say that without better security, the risks in all areas will continue to grow.
Despite the fighting, the World Food Programme reports it distributed food to more than 1 million people last month across South Sudan. Looking ahead, the UN Refugee Agency says it fears many people will not be able to flee areas of conflict because the rainy season will make roads and river crossings impassable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You were listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. At least 45 Nigerian security personnel are dead after gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants attacked a town in the country's northeastern Yobe state. And nearly 40 people are dead after Al-Shabaab militants attacked a village on the border between Ethiopia and Somalia. And the United States has called for calm in Malawi as the Election Commission continues to count votes in the presidential election. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. The Egyptian government has extended voting in the country's presidential election to a third day in a bid to push more electors to turn out. Egypt's Electoral Commission did not, however, give out voter participation figures, and polls remain open today until 10 p.m. local time. Former Defense Minister Abdullah Fattah al-Sisi is expected to win handily, but his supporters are hoping for a high turnout. Edward Uranian reports. From Cairo.
Women wearing headscarves cheered and ululated as voters lined up outside a women's polling station in the Cairo working class district of Imbaba. Many families took advantage of the official holiday to lounge around local polling stations, snacking on beans and falafel and listening to music. Government offices, banks, and the stock market were closed by government decree, and the normally thick weekday traffic was absent from most major thoroughfares. Music blared from loudspeakers at a polling station in the Mediterranean port city of Alexandria as lines dwindled under the midday sun. Egyptian TV correspondents questioned if the heat had pushed some voters to stay home. In the port city of Marsa Matruh, voter Abdullah Abdul Latif insisted he and his friends decided to vote in order to fulfill the official roadmap towards a return to democracy, which former defense minister and presidential candidate Abdel Fattah al-Sisi put forth last July after ousting the increasingly unpopular Islamist president Mohamed Morsi. Abdel Latif points out the heat turned back many voters Monday, but it had cooled off slightly Tuesday and people were voting normally. Egyptian TV showed an almost empty polling station in the city of Luxor as a polling official fanned himself briskly. Suddenly, a woman in a strict Islamic robe arrived to vote, causing a shuffle. The Muslim Brotherhood, which is strong in Luxor, has called on its supporters to boycott the election. At a polling station in the district of Manufia, north of Cairo, the local electoral head, Judge Wal Omran, said the vote was going smoothly and he anticipated no problems. He says when the local polling station closes, all the workers and observers will open the sealed plastic ballot boxes to count the votes and send the results to the main electoral office. Egypt's Electoral Commission Chief Tariq Shibl says official results from the two-day presidential election are to be announced late Tuesday. He said few complaints of irregularities from voting Monday were reported. Former Defense Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is facing leftist Hamdin Sabahi, is expected to win the election by a wide margin. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United States has called for calm in Malawi as the Election Commission continues to count the votes in the presidential election. At least 90% of the ballots were reported counted over the weekend. However, no winner has been announced. The U.S. has urged political leaders to reach a peaceful settlement amid charges of voting irregularities. Incumbent President Joyce Banda and opposition parties have filed lawsuits over the vote count. We'll be right back. South Africa's economy shrank more than 0.5% in the first quarter of the year. It's the worst performance since the global recession 5 years ago. Most of the decline is blamed on the country's prolonged platinum mining strike. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The decline in South Africa's economy follows a nearly 4% growth rate in the last quarter of 2013. However, the platinum mining strike is now in its fifth month. The government has made a new pledge to mediate the labor dispute, saying mining companies have not done enough to address the well-being of workers. David Shapiro, a director at Sasfin Securities, says the strike has been a big drag on the economy.
Platinum today is one of our biggest exports. In fact, certainly exceeds gold. You know, gold production in South Africa has fallen dramatically over the last decade or so, not for any reasons other than we've run out of cheap gold and it's more difficult to get to the gold. So platinum today is a major mineral export.
He describes the strike as a major worry. It's unclear how quickly the mining sector would bounce back once the strike does end.
When we talk about mines, if you keep them closed for that long, there are all kinds of issues, even if labor does come back to work. These are deep underground mines and require a lot of attention, so you can't neglect them. And even if they came back to work, it'll take some time to fire them up again.
Shapiro says local economies are formed where mines are located.
People live around the mines, and of course they earn their income there. They go out and spend it either in entertainment or they buy groceries. So every industry around the mine also starts to suffer as a result.
Many of the miners in South Africa are migrant workers. Mine companies offer them either a housing allowance or actual housing. Shapiro says the decision they make can have long-term financial effects.
A lot of these miners decided to accept a payment, an allowance instead. And what they did is, instead of buying a decent house or renting a decent house, they would send most of the money back home and then rent shacks. And when I say shacks, literally shacks, living in really dire circumstances, terrible conditions, and that started strike action.
Because of the strike, the miners are not being paid and are not able to send any money back home. In addition, there are also tensions between the trade unions representing the miners. And while miners demand higher wages, demand for platinum is currently down. South Africa's economy has also been affected by a slowdown in China's economy. Shapiro says from 2000 to 2010, the country benefited greatly from China's expansion and demand for natural resources such as iron ore, copper, and coal.
Now that China's slowing down, emerging countries such as South Africa, who are major exporters of minerals, are also starting to feel the pinch. So that's contributed as well.
Shapiro also says manufacturing in South Africa has declined as it imports cheaper goods. At the same time, families are under greater pressure to pay back loans and have cut back on buying consumer goods. Despite the first quarter's bad news, the Sasfin Securities director is optimistic, but he says South Africans are looking to the government to tackle some big issues.
We're a rich economy. It's a problem we can overcome. Yes, we've got a lot of people that are unemployed here. That's a throwback from apartheid. Skills development here is very low. But it's an economy that is blessed with so many natural resources. We have a massive array of minerals here. We have natural beauty which should attract tourism. It's a country that should be flourishing. We shouldn't be where we are.
Three mining companies are negotiating with AMCU, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union. However, little progress has been made so far regarding a pay hike. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As South Africa's ruling party settles in for another 5 years in power, the numbers show that the African National Congress's traditional support base, poor voters, has dwindled significantly. The drop in support could bode for a sea change in Africa's leading democracy and promise interesting elections in 2016. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to researchers in Johannesburg.
Just days before voters gave him another term in office, South African President Jacob Zuma drew a clear line across his nation's electorate, asserting that his traditional support base, South Africa's working class and poor, had no interest in the scandal involving public money used to make improvements to his private homestead in Nkandla.
The people are not worried about it. As a result, people don't think the Nkandla issue is a problem to affect ANC voters. Not at all. Absolutely, it's not an issue with the voters. It's an issue with the bright people. Very clever people is a big issue.
Mr. Zuma, who portrays himself as a populist, has often expressed derision for the people he labels clever, a group he variously defines to include intellectuals, urbanites, journalists, his critics, and anyone he feels has turned away from traditional African values. To strengthen the party's base, he has campaigned aggressively in rural, impoverished areas. And the nation's poor, who are almost all black, still largely back the ANC. But the long-standing idea that those voters will remain loyal to the ANC may be slowly crumbling, say researchers from the University of Johannesburg. Numbers from the May 7th election show the ANC dropped only 3% in overall support, but suffered more severe double-digit percentage drops in some areas. The UJ researchers spoke to 1,200 voters in three impoverished areas to try to find out why this is. Their study found that 56% of respondents support the ANC, which sounds high, but shows a steady decline in ANC support since 1994, when the party came to power. Researchers found declining youth support for the ANC. They also heard criticism of alleged corruption in the party, but found that among those living in dire poverty, those concerns were trumped by more tangible worries, such as the ANC government's poor record in reducing crime and maintaining infrastructure. They further found that residents were willing to shed party loyalties in local elections, a finding that could promise an exciting municipal election in 2016. Some analysts have already predicted that the ANC will struggle to hang on to the nation's economic powerhouse, Gauteng Province. Here's Professor Leila Patel.
In terms of those that would split their vote, there were quite a lot that said they would split their vote in terms of the national and the local elections.
Researchers say they plan to do more studies on what is still an emerging trend. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. At least 45 Nigerian security personnel are dead after gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants attacked a town in northeastern Yobe State. And nearly 40 people are dead after Al-Shabaab militants attacked a village on the border between Ethiopia and Somalia. Coming up, music from Namibia. And in our feature segment, a World Bank global report on gender equality. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Sunny, how are you?
Happy Tuesday, Yehiz.
I understand. You're kicking off again with World Cup football news.
Yehiz, we're now 16 days away until the kickoff of the Football World Cup in Brazil. And the teams from Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana, Nigeria, and Ivory Coast are continuing their preparations. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, Africa's five World Cup-bound teams getting ready for Brazil with some international friendly matches. VOA! How about an update for our VOA football fans?
That's right, Sonny. Nigeria, they'll go into action against Scotland in London on Wednesday evening. That's the first of three warm-up matches for the Nigerians. And after that game in London, Sonny, they're heading in your direction, going to the United States, which is also a favorite venue, incidentally, of Ghana and Ivory Coast. Then on Thursday, Cameroon are playing Paraguay in Austria, and then an even more difficult match for the indomitable Lions at the weekend. On Sunday, they're going to Mönchengladbach in Germany to take on Germany, one of the favorites for the World Cup. Then on Friday, the Ivorians, Ivory Coast, the Elephants. The tip of many Africans to be the strongest contenders at the World Cup from Africa. They will take on fellow qualifiers Bosnia-Herzegovina. That match will be played in St. Louis in the United States. Voice of America! And then on Saturday, a very attractive pairing in Rotterdam. It's the Netherlands against Ghana, so that'll be Ghana's first outing. Now, of course, Sonny, you should never read too much into these friendly matches because whereas some coaches may field what they consider to be their full-strength side, other coaches, and I certainly would support this, will experiment. Who would be the best centre-back combination? Who are the best holding midfielders? Who are the best wide midfielders? Which is the best striking combination? And that's actually maybe the key word, combinations. What these friendlies will do is they will tell the coach whether A and B are better than B and C, etc. So often in the past, Sonny, certainly I have as a reporter, we can read too much into these friendly results. I was very pleased that Cameroon, the officials there, did not panic after that March friendly in Portugal when the Portuguese, inspired as always by Cristiano Ronaldo, hammered the indomitable Lions 5-1. Now, I can think back maybe 5 years. The coach, Volker Fink from Germany, would immediately have been fired on the basis of that result. And that would have been so unfair because friendly matches can be a very valuable exercise in testing the strengths and weaknesses of a team in the build-up to the World Cup. So let's all enjoy these friendlies. Let's watch them with interest. Let's analyze the results. But at the same time, remember, they are just that. They are friendlies. Speaking from here in South Africa, we know all too well the pitfalls, Sonny, of friendly matches. Late last year, Bafana Bafana beat Spain, the reigning world and European champions, 1-0, and some people got totally carried away. They thought, now we're the champions of the world. Well, Brazil came in March, and I'll whisper it, it was 5-0 to the Brazilians.
David, you mentioned a few of the African teams coming here to the States where we have just begun the summer season. It gets quite hot and muggy in certain locations. Nigeria will be playing the USA in Jacksonville, Florida, where it can get very hot. How important is it for these teams to acclimate themselves to the Brazilian heat?
Oh, crucial, Sonny. You hit the nail on the head there. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've chosen the United States. I mean, also, I've got no doubt that the facilities in the United States, they're as good as anywhere in the world. And the climate is crucial. I mean, to draw a ridiculous scenario, I mean, you're certainly not going to go to Iceland to prepare for a World Cup in Brazil. It just wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. What you've got to do, Sonny, as you said, is replicate as far as possible. If it's hot and muggy in Brazil, then you've got to go to the hot and muggy places in the United States. Voice of America! I'm generally happy, Sonny. The African teams, unlike some past World Cups where the preparations were, to put it mildly, haphazard, this time they seem to have got their act together. They planned these friendly matches well in advance. I noticed there's a mixture. They're playing some non-qualifiers and they're also playing some qualifiers. I mean, if you look at Ghana, they're taking on Holland, but they're also playing some other countries that haven't made it to the World Cup. I don't think you want to play all tough matches, and I don't think you want to play all weak matches either. If you play too many tough matches, you might just be worn out before the World Cup. And on the other hand, if you win matches 8, 9, 10 nil all the time, you might think you're world beaters before you get to Brazil and then come in for a rude surprise when the event starts. But the United States, Sonny, there's an awful lot of friendly matches taking place there. It's a real treat for all the American football lovers. And I think that's also a tribute to the facilities, because I noticed there are matches in the South, the East, all over the United States. So it's almost like a World Cup before the World Cup, Sonny.
David, how about a look at some recent friendly results?
Yes, Sonny. Apart from the World Cup, other countries have been using this break at the end of the European season in preparation for the Africa Cup of Nations, which, of course, the group stage kicks off in September. And other countries like Mozambique, they've got a match this coming weekend against South Sudan. And it was interesting that Mozambique, who hammered South Sudan in Maputo by 5-0, they went to Faro in Portugal. And they were at the receiving end of a hiding this time. They were beaten 4-0 by Morocco. Very impressive win there for the Lions of the Atlas. This was the first match in charge of the Moroccan side for their new coach, Badou Zaki. He's a goalkeeper. He played in the 1986 World Cup when Morocco became the first African team to reach the second round of a World Cup. He was previously in charge in the mid-2000s. And they reached the 2004 Africa Cup of Nations final, losing 2-1 to the host nation, Tunisia. So Zaki back in charge. And it was 2 goals, Sonny, in each half. So a very impressive win there. Morocco 4, Mozambique 0. In Geneva, in Switzerland, Senegal beat Kosovo by 3-1. The Senegalese Lions fell behind. But then a goal late in the first half and 2 early in the second half gave the Teranga Lions a 3-1 victory. At Colombe in France, that's a suburb of Paris, Guinea, you could say, surprised Mali 2-1. I don't think, again, one should read too much into friendlies. But before that game, I think the Malians would have been the favourites of most people to win. They did take the lead after 8 minutes through Sako. But Landell equalized on the half-hour mark, and Yatara converted a penalty with 17 minutes left. So Guinea 2, Mali 1. So those are the 3 friendly results from the weekend.
David, one other friendly result from Monday night in Sydney. World Cup-bound Australia draws with South Africa 1-1. South Africa, of course, the 2010 World Cup host. Your thoughts on this match?
This was a big surprise, Sonny. Bafana Bafana went to Australia basically as lambs to the slaughter. In fact, the Aussie press, and they're never shy to stick the dagger in. And before the game, they said it's not Bafana Bafana, it's Bafana Bafas. And what they were referring to, Sonny, was the composition of the Bafana Bafana lineup. The coach, Gordon Eggerson, of the original 18 players he chose, 9 pulled out with injuries. I've never known so many players to be injured just before the team headed off to Australia. And I believe the general feeling among the South African media and also among the football public is that perhaps some players were just very, very tired at the end of a long season and they just didn't fancy that long trip down under. And also, Sonny, on Friday night, they play New Zealand in Auckland. The net result of this was that the lineup against Australia contained only four at the most of what you would consider to be the first-choice South African side. But they did extremely well. Ayanda Patosi, who plays in Belgium, he scored after 13 minutes to surprise a 50,000 crowd at the Olympic Stadium in Sydney. Within 1 minute, Tim Cahill, now there's a name all our listeners who follow the English Premier League will remember. He gave great service for many years to Everton. He levelled within 60 seconds, and I guess most South Africans felt, well, here goes, now we're going to take a hiding. But it wasn't the case, Sonny. The South Africans battled away. And this has happened often in the past. When Iggeson takes these so-called depleted or weak sides, the spirit level seems to rise. They don't have the big names, but they have a lot of fighting spirit. And in the end, they were pretty deserved holders of the Aussies. And on the basis of that match, Sonny, I'm offering the odds of maybe 1,000 to 1 on Australia winning against Chile, Netherlands, or Spain at the World Cup.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. The National Basketball Association playoffs continue later Tuesday night when the Oklahoma City Thunder host the San Antonio Spurs in Game 4 of the Western Conference Finals. San Antonio leads the best-of-seven-game series 2-1. Oklahoma City got a boost in Game 3 with the return of Congolese forward Serge Ibaka, who had 15 points and 4 block shots. Ibaka missed the first two games of the series with a calf injury. In Game 4 of the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals Monday night, the two-time defending champion Miami Heat defeated the Indiana Pacers 102-90. Miami now leads 3-1 and can advance once again to the NBA Finals with a victory in Indiana on Wednesday night. Superstar LeBron James had 32 points and 10 rebounds in Miami's win Monday night. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. In recent weeks, the U.S. government has issued travel advisories for parts of Kenya. This, as the country has faced terrorist attacks blamed on the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Jean Kamal is Kenya's ambassador to the United States. She told VOA's Vincent Makori that Kenya is concerned about the travel warnings.
Well, because we feel that the travel advisories were not necessary at this time, because all efforts had been put in place to provide the safety and security of our citizens and all our visitors. And in fact, the countries that issued the advisories were working very well with the government on these efforts. They are some of our partners on security and safety issues, because terrorism is not peculiar to Kenya. It's a regional challenge, and the peace and security of Kenya is very well, is connected to the peace and security of the region. So we feel that this is a fact that was well known to these countries. We're working together very well with them to address these challenges. So the advisories have come at the back of an issue that we feel was not necessary, and that efforts were still in place to continue working together.
Mm-hmm. But now some would say, well, since the mall attack last year, there has been only an escalation of these attacks up to this point, and some are thinking perhaps Kenya is not doing a great job stemming these attacks. What's your response?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, because this is an ongoing effort. The safety and security of our nation is something that is a priority for our country. Our security forces are up to the task, up to the challenge of providing security. The level of an escalation of the crime that we've witnessed is changing, but we are also, you know, well aware that this is a challenge that we're up to. And, you know, despite what you've said that since the Westgate attack, that there's been an escalation. Actually, there's been a response to mitigate what would be even a worse scenario in some situations. So we feel that, you know, that we are on top of the challenge that our country is facing, and working with our partners in the region, in the East African region, and in fact, the, you know, IGAD and the AU, that we are addressing the security challenges.
But if you come to very specific things, what are those measures that you can say have been put in place to reassure somebody who is just about to buy a ticket and come to Kenya so they can believe it is safe for them to be there?
Well, first of all, there's enhanced surveillance efforts at the border points and even within the towns to ensure that citizens and visitors alike feel protected, and they can move about their business without fear, and that there's a visible presence of security officers to ensure that people's security is paramount. Secondly, all our agencies, the law enforcement agencies, are working round the clock all the time to provide advisories to the local citizens, where there's an upscale of a threat, what citizens need to be aware of, to be more alert around their surroundings, so that they cooperate. There's increased cooperation and enhancement and partnership between citizens and the security officers.
Now, some were saying, well, Al-Shabaab seems to be widening its network within the country. Mm-hmm. Is this accurate, and how does this change the game plan?
Well, Al-Shabaab is a threat to our national security. There's no doubt about that. They have made a case that they will attack Kenya, and they have joined forces with Al-Qaeda and have even issued and have pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda, which is something that is in the public domain, and that they have threatened the state of Kenya, and that they have said they will disrupt economic activity. So we are well aware that of their stated objectives, and that the challenge that Al-Shabaab threatens not just Kenya, but even other countries like Uganda, and countries which are actively in Somalia at the moment in an effort to stabilize the country. So we are aware that Al-Shabaab is a threat to our security, and we're working to mitigate and to stem that threat.
And that actually is spreading the network. It's getting wider.
It's spreading. I wouldn't agree that it's spreading, but it is a known threat to the region and to our country.
Okay. Now, very briefly, in the crackdown against the suspected terrorists, the Kenyan government has come under criticism for human rights violations, especially against refugees of Somali origin. Is the government reviewing the way it's conducting the operation?
Yeah, let me assure you that this operation, as you've made reference to, which was known as Usalama Watch, which is basically an effort by the government to respond to the type of violence and criminal activity that we witnessed in the urban areas. And it was the responsibility of the government to do something. And the response was to verify the identity of foreigners who were living within the urban boundaries of Nairobi and out of the city. We've even gone to other towns to verify that there were not criminal elements that were taking advantage of their undocumented presence to cause mayhem. Mm-hmm. And those refugees who were not supposed to be in the urban centers were sent back to their camps. Now, just to verify that this effort did not target members of one ethnic or tribal community, but actually addressed a cross range of foreigners who were in the country. It even included American citizens, people from New Zealand, people from Nigeria, people from Uganda. So it affected a cross section of people who were in Kenya, whose identity had to be verified. Mm-hmm. So just to confirm that, and all efforts were taken by the government to ensure it was humanely done, and that we addressed all the concerns of those who were subjected to this verification exercise.
That's Kenya's ambassador to the U.S., Jean Kamal. She was speaking to VOA's Vincent Macori. The World Bank released a global report titled Voice and Agency, Empowering Women and Girls for Shared Prosperity. The study outlines the constraints women and girls face worldwide, from gender-based violence to decision-making. Odette Fraser spoke with the World Bank Group Director for Gender and Development, Jenny Klugman, who noted that despite the improvement in gender equality, women still do not have a voice in making decisions about their own lives.
This report was motivated by the observation that there had been enormous progress in gender equality over time, in particular in terms of improving enrollment at school, improving women's health outcomes, some improvements in economic opportunities, but the gains in terms of women's voice, that is their capacity to participate in decision-making in the community and the public at large, as well as in terms of agency, which is decision-making about whether and how many children to have, being able to own property, being free from violence, had been areas where there was much less progress. So there were areas where we wanted to try and understand what was going on and what could be done.
What were some of the glaring issues on the report that need immediate attention?
I think the findings about violence are really so striking, that one in three women globally have been victims of violence, either sexual or physical abuse, and that the vast majority of this has been at the hands of their husbands or boyfriends. I think that's one that really stands out. The rates of child marriage being so high in many countries, the number of unintended pregnancies, that's pregnancies that women either had wanted to delay or not have at all, number 80 million annually. So there's a whole range of, I think, very striking figures that were uncovered and explored by the report.
Data from 33 developing countries revealed that almost one-third of women lack sexual and reproductive rights. Why does it feel like this issue is not being given the attention it needs by the respective countries and the international community at large?
Well, I think there's a range of constraints. What we do find is that women who are better educated and who are in wealthier households tend to have more access to these rights. And so it's related to, I think, some deep structural issues. It's also related to kind of attitudes and norms which are held within households by women as well as by men about respective rights. And I think in a number of countries, particularly poorer countries, lack of access to services still plays a very important role.
The report builds on the 2012 World Development Report, which focused on several areas pertinent to women's empowerment, freedom from violence, etc., were the recommendations of the 2012 World Development Report met?
Well, the World Development Report, I think, laid an important foundation for the work that we've pursued here with this focus on voice and agency. We're moving in very much the same directions. I think there's a lot more that we know about what works, and we're able to highlight that in the report. So, for example, we did deeper analysis of what works to prevent violence, for example, that programs which involve boys and involve men, which work at the community level, which span longer periods of time, are much more likely to be successful. So that's, I think, a new and encouraging finding. I think the findings that we present around education and the importance of education and the links of that to the prevention of violence, I think, are very important as well. So it's moving along in the same direction, but I think with an accumulation of evidence which allows larger insights.
Based on the report that has been released, is there an action plan?
What we do in the report is to expose problems at the global level and the patterns and disparities across regions, across countries, but to work out what makes sense in any specific context requires a lot more in terms of country-level diagnostic, and we've not yet done that in the report. What we do, I think, very importantly, is lay out strategic directions around the expansion of economic opportunities, of education, social protection programs, and the features and the considerations which need to be taken into account in order to make those effective. But in order to actually undertake the concrete actions, much more is needed at the country level to work out what makes sense, what are the specific constraints, and obviously what are the funding requirements as well.
Jenny Klugman is the World Bank's Director for Gender and Development. She was speaking with Odette Fraser from Washington, D.C.
This
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Adrius Regis, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Voters in Guinea-Bissau helped the West African nation take a large step toward returning to democratic rule, turning out in good numbers to choose former finance minister José Mário Vaz as president in the May 18th runoff election. In balloting seen by international monitors as transparent, credible, and without major incident, Mr. Vaz received 61.9% of the vote, defeating independent candidate Nunu Gomes Nabiam, who took 38.1%. The nation's Supreme Court must now validate the results before they become official. A decision is expected in the coming days. Mr. Vaz is the first freely elected president since a coup disrupted voting in 2012. A transitional government has ruled since the military surrendered power, and the new president taking office will end that transition back to elected rule. The United States congratulates the people of Guinea-Bissau and looks forward to working with Mr. Vaz and his government as it works to achieve lasting peace in the region. We also commend Mr. Nabiam for accepting the result and conceding for the sake of peace and stability. We urge the country's leaders, both civilian and military, to hear the voice of their people and bring the political transition period to a successful conclusion. These elections offer the opportunity for comprehensive reforms to break Guinea-Bissau's cycle of corruption and make progress on providing public services, advancing democracy, and expanding the country's development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
African music.
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. you'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.